loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Brian Becker. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, former President George H.W. Bush died over the weekend at the age of 94. His body will lie in state in the U.S. Capitol, and a funeral will take place on Wednesday. We'll look at the Bush presidency and the Bush legacy each day this week, focusing on a different issue. Today, we'll talk about the invasion of Panama. Next, rioting across France continued to spread over the weekend, with students blockading more than 100 high schools to protest changes in the country's university entrance system. Protesters also blockaded 11 fuel depots in northern France, causing severe gas shortages. But polls show that 72% of French adults support the protests, and they show no sign of waning. Then, today, we continue our segment Education for Liberation with Bill Ayers, where Bill helps us look at the state of education across the country. What's happening in our schools, colleges, and universities, and what impact does it have on the world around us? And then, three St. Louis police officers who beat an undercover colleague during a protest last year turned themselves in after being indicted on federal charges. A fourth also was indicted for lying to a grand jury about the incident. And finally, the far-right Vox Party stunned Spain this weekend by winning seats in the Andalusian regional parliament. The party won 12 seats and 11% of the vote on a platform of expelling all immigrants from Spain and ending Catalonia's political autonomy. That's all coming up next on Loud and Clear.
Now we turn to George H.W. Bush and his role in the invasion of Panama. Former President Bush died over the weekend at age 94. His body will lie in state at the U.S. Capitol, and a funeral will take place on Wednesday. We'll look at the Bush presidency and the Bush legacy each day this week, focusing on different issues. Today, we're going to talk about the December 1989 invasion of Panama. We are joined from New York City by Kim Ives. He is an editor of the newspaper Haiti Liberté. Kim Ives, welcome back to Loud and Clear.
Thank you, Brian. Thank you, John.
You know, the whole media apparatus in this country, at least the corporate-owned media apparatus, is singing the praises of George H.W. Bush this week. He was a man of civility, a man of decency, the long-lost past of the United States. The sort of praise that's being given to George H.W. Bush misses a big part of the Bush legacy and the Bush story. Kim Ives, we want to talk to you about why this president, George H.W. Bush, ordered the invasion of Panama and what happened to the people in Panama. Go ahead.
Well, it was a buildup over several years leading up to the invasion in 89. I think the key to it was the fact that Panama was to take back the canal, ownership of the canal, in the year 2000. And even the New York Times went to the point to say, well, Manuel Noriega, the president at that time, was not taking into account U.S. strategic interests in the canal. So I think it began a little bit under Reagan, for whom Bush was, of course, vice president, and they were engaged in a war against the Nicaragua, against the Sandinistas in Nicaragua. And to some extent, Panamanians apparently had been asked to also host Contras and take part in that war, along with Honduras, who was were providing the territory from which the Contras attacked Nicaragua. That was their base in Honduras. And apparently Noriega was resisting, helping in that war. But the principal thing was the canal. And when Torrijos, President Torrijos, who was killed in 1981, it appears with CIA involvement in that bombing of his helicopter or plane, I believe, that crashed and killed him. He had signed the treaty back in 1977, and basically this was to reestablish U.S. control of this wayward colony or neo-colony, which was essentially created by the U.S. by Teddy Roosevelt back at the turn of the last century in 1903. They sort of amputated Panama from Colombia so that they could put the canal and run the canal and own the canal.
I mean, it was a way of connecting the industrial heartland and the eastern seaboard of the United States with the ability to trade or send goods and products to Asia. And of course, the U.S. invaded the Philippines right around the same time as the capturing of that part of Colombia that was turned into Panama and thus made possible the Panama Canal. The canal was very critically important to the emergence of the United States as an imperial power.
Correct. It was from Panama. Many of the initial imperial adventures of the young United States were in Panama, were in the area, I mean, before it was Panama, when it was still Colombia. In fact, William Walker, who had made the Kingdom of Nicaragua in the middle of the 19th century, U.S. Imperial adventurer, also had designs on that area. It was, you know, what I was very surprised by, Brian, I'll just mention that here. I was down in Colombia this past summer, and I'd never realized that there are absolutely no roads going from Colombia to Panama. There, it is divided by a jungle called the Darien Gap, which is a very forbidding area filled with all sorts of perils for some of the migrants who come up the Panamanian Highway, among them Haitians, on their way to try to get to the U.S. And so this, I think, is part of the sort of separation or the amputation of Panama from Latin America, from the South American continent.
Let's bring it back to George H.W. Bush. I was part of something called the Independent Commission of Inquiry on the U.S. invasion of Panama. It was initiated by Ramsey Clark. Ramsey Clark had gone to Panama in December, right after the invasion, and he was quoted in the New York Times as saying that there was a curtain of silence about the number of civilian casualties, Panamanians who died. Because in the media, John, you'll remember that this invasion was presented as something bloodless, that nobody got hurt.
Oh, it was quick and easy and bloodless. So yes.
Just captured Manuel Noriega.
Right.
Clark himself thought thousands had died. He's the former U.S. Attorney General. So we set up a commission of inquiry, and we went down, we sent delegations to Panama, we met with Panamanians, we interviewed Panamanians who had been arrested and were imprisoned by the U.S. military. We went to the neighborhoods, the poor neighborhoods, especially where Noriega had more support and where the U.S. invasion met more resistance. And there were mass graves that people were able to dig up. Again, the presentation now about George H.W. Bush's legacy, Kim Ives, is, hey, he was just a civil, wonderful, decent guy, not an imperialist, not carrying out something like the invasion of what was basically a defenseless country so that the United States could reassert its authority over one of its prized colonial possessions, that would be the Panama Canal. It's a legacy that's been whitewashed. There was a lot of death and a lot of destruction in Panama. I know you helped make a movie about that.
Right. It was destroyed, as in particular the neighborhood of El Chorrillo, which was totally destroyed through U.S. bombing, rocket fire, house-to-house arson. It was Ramsey Clark described the mass grave that he paced off himself. He said it was 18 feet wide by 120 feet long. At the beginning, really before that commission, which was, of course, one of the first that Ramsey Clark did with various groups over the coming decades, Panama, as well as Iraq, Haiti, many other countries. But really, the Panama inquiry was the first of many. And originally, they had said it was 84 people who were killed. That's the Southern Command's figure. But after the investigation of this independent commission, they had to up that, I think, to 500. And then, but of course, Ramsey Clark and the commission felt that it was at least 1,000 and possibly several thousand people who died. But definitely that El Chorrillo neighborhood where the people came out in the streets to defend their country against these invading Marines. They were wiped out. They were bombed and machine gunned.
I know that we don't have much time left, but I have to say, you know, I'm a pretty well-informed person. I always have been, and I've never heard this story before. Why is it? And Brian, I'll ask you to start, really. Why is it that this never found its way into the mainstream media? Why is it that Americans don't know this story?
Yeah, we made a movie about it, by the way. I mean, not we. The mm-hmm. work that we did in the Independent Commission became the basis for a movie called Panama Deception. Panama Deception. That movie, John, won the Oscars for the best documentary in the mid-1990s, and it was never shown in a U.S. theater. No theaters would take it, even though it won the Oscar for best documentary. We had to rent a theater, like in New York City. Kim, I'm sure you'll remember, we rented a theater in the East Village on 2nd Avenue and 11th Street to show that movie because, whatever, there was a boycott of news and information and the truth about the invasion of Panama. Thus, the Panama Deception was kept out of the minds and the consciousness of the American people. We have 1 minute left, Kim. I want to just ask you really quick, and we should have discussed this earlier. There was also George H.W. Bush's role in the coup in Haiti.
Absolutely. That was the second act, we could say. I mean, after they did some sort of electoral coup in Nicaragua some months later. But then the Haitian population basically responded to the U.S. empire in December 1990 by electing Jean-Bertrand Aristide. And the Bush administration was very vexed with that basically participated with the Haitian elites in overthrowing that government in September 1991. And, you know, at first they came out, James Baker, his then Secretary of State, came and said, oh, the coup will not stand. But within a week, they were basically saying, well, Aristide brought it on himself. Jean-Bertrand Aristide was a dictator, was mob rule, was et cetera, et cetera. And not only that, Brian and John, but he also really pioneered the concentration camp at Guantanamo Bay. That was the first time they used it for warehousing Haitians who were fleeing the dictatorship that followed that September 91 coup.
Well, that's all the time we have. We're going to look more at the legacy of George H.W. Bush with Kim Ives in a follow-up segment, again, focusing this time on the coup, the 1991 coup that overthrew the progressive government in Haiti. We were joined from New York City by Kim Ives. Kim is an editor of the newspaper Haiti Liberté. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Rioting across France continued to spread over the weekend, with students blockading more than 100 high schools to protest changes in the country's university entrance system. Protesters also blockaded 11 fuel depots in northern France, causing severe gas shortages. But polls show that 72% of French adults support the protests, and they show no sign of waning. We're joined by Gilbert Mercier. He is the editor-in-chief of News Junkie Post and the author of The Orwellian Empire. Gilbert, welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me, you guys.
Hey, Gilbert, tell us how these protests started and why they're called the Yellow Vest or Yellow Jacket protests.
The Gilets Jaunes is a protest that started. It's a complete grassroots, spontaneous type of protest. And the Gilets Jaunes symbolize blue collar, if you wish. It symbolizes a revolt of the working class and retirees, because there's actually a lot of retirees, against the power to be in the suits of the political class and the CEOs. Some people have compared that, even in France, to May 1968, but the demographic is rather different, because we're talking about a much wider a group of population. As you noted in your introduction, today the high school students massively joined the Gilets Jaunes all over France. And they were actually clash with the CRS, with the riot police. But the comparison with 68, and I've mentioned that on another Sputnik show, Transtorm, is not accurate in the sense that in 68, it started in Paris, and it was really a student revolt, more for like freedom as opposed to social justice, and more against sort of the authority of the parents, and kind of in the vein of the sexual revolution of the late 60s, you know, kind of like in the US with the sort of vaguely hippie movement of peace and love. So this is not what it's about, and this is about bread and butter. It's not about free love. As I mentioned before, and it's really, if I was going to make an analogy, and that should be extremely scary for the Macron administration, this is more like the French sans-culottes of 1789, of the French Revolution. And it's, you know, the French media all over the weekend on Saturday, they were talking about guerrilla urban guerrilla, and the scenes in Paris and elsewhere, because it's not only in Paris, of like burning car and even burning building and clash with the cops, were extremely surprised a lot of people. But they are attacking what those people are doing, and they've been called by all kind of names by the media, casseurs mainly, which kind of take away a political aspect of those people. In my mind, they're more like insurgents. They're not casseurs, mean breaking things just for no reason. They break things for a reason, and I'll tell you why. The weekend before, the Target were luxury store that most French people cannot afford, like Louis Vuitton, Christian Dior. This weekend, it was also banks. A lot of banks have been targeted because what it is, you guys, it's really an anti-capitalist movement.
Mm-hmm.
This is what it is at its core, even if it's not using per se a Marxist ideology, but this is what it is. And you did point out the wide support among French people, and it's actually not 72%, it's 75% of French people support the Gilets Jaunes, which is huge compared to the 25% approval rating of Macron, and that is dropping every day. There's a disconnect, and I mention that all the time. There's a disconnect between almost all world leaders and their people. And this is what's going on in France. And the thing is, what people should keep in mind in France, the French government, in the French DNA, and very few people in the world have that in their DNA, there's a possibility of, yes, a revolution. And this is what could be happening now. I'm not saying that it's going to happen. But this is definitely a preliminary stage because it's not going away.
Well, let me ask you then, if this is not going away, and I agree with you, because if anything, it seems like these protests are getting bigger and they're very reminiscent of what we saw in the summer of 1968. What does this do to the Macron government? Is there a danger that Macron could fall?
It's funny that you mentioned that because more and more people, and they actually did that in his face yesterday. He came back from Argentina from the G20, and he went to the Arc de Triomphe, and he could see tagging on the building saying Macron démission, and people, he walked around, you know, and people were shouting Macron démission, which is Macron resign, and that's more and more becoming the tone of the protest here. Now, what I want to mention is that politically, okay, the Rassemblement National of Marine Le Pen on the far right and the France Insoumise of Jean-Luc Mélenchon on the left are both asking for a dissolution of the National Assembly. So this is very serious. So I mean, France is in a political crisis now. This temptation coming from the new Minister of Interior, Castanier, and the COPS syndicate, to put back the état d'urgence, the state of emergency that was in force in France from 13th of November to 2015 for 2 years to 2017. But some people, like the Ministry of Justice, rightly think that it would be a horrible solution for the Macron government because, it's my opinion as well, it would radicalize even more the Gilets Jaunes. So they're going to have to give in. They're going to have one way or another to compromise on the very precise list. There's 42 points, which is, of course, not only about the freezing the increase of gas taxes, but it's also putting back the tax on the rich, the ISF, the impôt sur la fortune, which was scrapped by Macron, because Macron is the president of the rich. As a matter of fact, like his predecessor Hollande indicated, not even the president of the rich, but the president of the ultra-rich. People are tired of this. People see that capitalism is a dead end, and this is what's going on. Quite frankly, I hope it spreads to the rest of Europe and maybe elsewhere, you know.
What should we expect to happen then in the coming days and weeks? As you said, this is pushing French society to two separate sides, and the protests are wildly popular. Macron is less and less popular as weeks pass. What's going to happen next?
Well, look, when you have a demographic from roughly between 15 to like in your 70s in a population, you have a problem. And this is what Macron is dealing with. So he's going to have to be extremely cautious. And if he goes the route of repression, because overall between last week and last Saturday and the one before, with the riot on the Champs-Élysées, 500 people have been put under arrest, and they want to be extremely tough and get them to do jail time and so on. The way of the repression is not the way to go. So what could happen to Macron if he had any kind of dignity? And he doesn't, obviously. He would follow the route of De Gaulle in 68 and resign. Because that's basically what De Gaulle did, you know, but he's not going to do that. So what he's going to do, I think what he's probably going to do, because in France, you know, you have this prime minister who sort of like act like, if you wish, like a fuse, meaning that if there's a crisis, if policy are unpopular, you get rid of the prime minister and pick another one.
And in fact, it's the prime minister that has been out in the streets talking to the protesters to try to defuse some of these situations. And I'm sorry that we're out of time. We were joined by Gilbert Mercier. He's the editor-in-chief of News Junkie Post, and he's the author of The Orwellian Empire. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay tuned. We'll be back in a minute.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Today we continue our segment, Education for Liberation, with Bill Ayers, where Bill helps us look at the state of education across the country. What's happening in our schools, colleges, and universities, and what impact does it have on the world around us? Bill joins us from Chicago. He's an activist, educator, and the co-author of the new book, You Can't Fire the Bad Ones, and 18 Other Myths About Teachers, Teachers' Unions, and Public Education. You can check out his work at www.billayers.org. Welcome back, Bill.
Nice to hear your voices. Good to be here.
Bill, last summer, I guess it was last summer, late summer, we talked a lot about teacher strikes around the country. We talked about West Virginia, North Carolina, Arizona, Oklahoma. They were all over the place. You've flagged for our attention an interesting case in Oakland, California, where teachers have actually been working without a contract for more than a year, and it's only now that they're threatening to strike. What's happening in Oakland?
Well, it's not, as you pointed out, it's not just Oakland. It's a national phenomenon. But what we witnessed in the spring was the uprising of teachers from red states who had suffered from budget cuts and being targeted as kind of the problem and the enemy of children. And they'd had enough, and they wildcat strikes spread all over the country. But let's not be deluded. This is a crisis in Chicago, Minneapolis, Los Angeles, and as you say, in Oakland. So what we're witnessing is the results of 30 years of corporate school reform, and the targeting of teachers and teachers' unions is somehow the enemy of education, which in reality is just the opposite. We could talk about that. And the cutting of budgets, the severe cutting of budgets, so that people have had to have 2-3 jobs, drive an Uber, wait tables, and it's coming to a head. The other place it's coming to a head, incidentally, and this is breaking news, is that in Chicago tomorrow, we are likely to witness the first strike of charter school teachers who have been organized by the Chicago Alliance of Teachers and of Chicago Teachers and Staff, affiliated now with the Chicago Teachers Union. But this has been an effort that's been going on for a couple of years, and charter school teachers are now organized and getting ready to act.
There's a piece in the San Francisco Chronicle that really puts things into perspective, at least in Oakland. It says that Oakland pays its teachers a starting salary of $46,000 a year. $46,000 a year. The average rent is $2,527. And it says a lot of teachers are leaving to go to neighboring school districts, because all you have to do is leave Oakland. You cross into San Leandro, it starts at $60,000. Hayward starts at $61,000. Fremont starts at $65,000. We're seeing the same thing happening in Kansas, the entire state of Kansas, where teachers are going to other states. They're going to, for example, Iowa or Missouri, because the pay is so much better and they don't have to go so deeply out of pocket for basic classroom supplies.
And just for people who couldn't do the math that quickly, $2,500 a month rent is $30,000 a year. And we're talking about a $46,000 a year salary.
So it essentially takes literally all of your net pay.
Yeah, it's an astonishing situation. And if you widen the lens and look at the whole country, what you're looking at is a country, a society driven by this kind of single-minded corporate school reform for the last three decades, where the corporate school reformers have had all the foundations on their side, most of the bought media, the liberal press, the New York Times, and they've been pushing an agenda. And the agenda is that teachers should not have collective bargaining. They should not have the right to a union. Education should be reduced to a single metric on a test score, and the public space should be privatized. This is coming to a head, and it's going to come to an end. But if you take the long view and the big picture, what you're seeing is a society that has decided, all this is deeply contested, but has decided to shortchange teachers and students for the interest of profit. And it is, in the long run, catastrophic for any society. The end of public education is the end of democracy in even its aspirational form. So this is a huge fight, and the fight is being engaged in Oakland, in Los Angeles, in their charter schools in Chicago, and it's both a dazzling, exciting, and critical thing that we all get involved in.
Let's talk about what's going on in Los Angeles. Let's stay in California a little bit.
Well, the thing that's interesting to me about Los Angeles, and it goes back to the beginning of teachers unionizing, is that in Los Angeles, we're seeing a repetition of what we saw in those wildcat strikes and also what we saw in Chicago 5 years ago, which is that instead of being able to be cornered into saying teachers looking out for salaries and benefits are somehow some self-interested little monopoly, it's not true. What teachers in Los Angeles are saying is, we are in partnership with parents, we are in partnership with communities, and what we're demanding is basically a social justice agenda. We want smaller classes. We want the arts in the schools. We want physical education. We want to take care of the whole child. Very much what children of privilege get all the time routinely, but which kids in Los Angeles, Chicago, Seattle, New York, Newark don't get. And that's what's so remarkable about this current wave of teacher activism, is that it's in partnership with parents and community, and it's demanding what's good for all kids. And frankly, as I've said many times, good working conditions are good teaching conditions, and good teaching conditions are good learning conditions. So the idea that teachers are striking for themselves or are some kind of selfish, self-interested group is a huge myth and a falsehood.
Let's also talk just for a moment. It just struck me this morning when I was thinking about this segment about how money, governmental money, which is tax money, is dispersed. You have in New York City, there's these huge subsidies going to Amazon so that they can, quote, bring in 25,000 jobs, which is not creating 25,000 jobs. It's bringing in 25,000 already high paid, you know, engineers, et cetera. That money will drive up, you know, real estate prices, et cetera. More people will become homeless. But there's 10% of the students in New York City public schools, as we've talked about before, are homeless. 10%, 114,000 kids.
It's a shocking statistic.
Yeah, 100. And here you have the city, municipal, state governments dishing out money to mega monopolies like Amazon with the hope that maybe that will spur economic activity, with the hope that maybe that will bring jobs and more revenue. Meanwhile, that money could be going to schools. That money could be going to decent teachers' pay. That money could be going to kids who really won't be able to succeed without a decent education. And right now, the decent education just isn't there for them. Go ahead, Bill.
I couldn't agree with you more, Brian. I mean, you're absolutely correct. And we hit on Amazon last week, but let's not overlook, let's widen the lens once again. Let's look at military spending. Or in the city of Chicago, let's look at the budget in terms of police versus the budget for schools. To me, an absolute recipe for social suicide in Chicago is closing 50 schools in poor neighborhoods and opening a police academy for $95 million. Nationwide, what we are witnessing, and we've seen it now, an editorial in the New York Times on Saturday, they just did an audit of the Pentagon, the first audit ever done of the Pentagon, and the Pentagon failed the audit. They can't account for billions and billions of dollars. So what are we doing as a society? If we spend this huge percentage on the military, we can't even account for where the money went in the most corrupt kind of cash-sucking institution we have. And meanwhile, we can't afford to pay teachers a living wage in Oakland or in Los Angeles or in Chicago. It's an outrage. And I think we ought to all wake up to it. I call it social suicide, but I think it's right up there with militarism, with white supremacy, and with kind of the environmental collapse as something that we're facing as a generation. And it's an existential crisis.
We only have about 2 minutes left. And Bill, you flagged for us a very interesting and very important piece from the New York Times. Are civics lessons a constitutional right? One of my favorite insults is to say to someone, sir, you are in dire need of a 10th grade civics lesson. I love that insult. But the truth is that many Americans actually are in a dire need of a civics lesson because civics are no longer taught in many schools. People don't know, students don't know what taxes are collected for. They don't know how to vote. They don't know what the difference is between a Republican and a Democrat. And there's a new lawsuit that is challenging that. Tell us about it.
Well, I think what's important about that story, you're absolutely right that we are civically, you know, illiterate as a country. We don't know geography. We don't know history. As Europeans often say about us, we don't know where we are. We don't know who we are. So it's a real crisis. The one thing I would quibble with is I don't think there was a golden age when civics was taught. I think that being ignorant of civics, being ignorant about how the government works is kind of part of the structure of how power operates. Keeping people in the dark, blindfolded, and with their ears plugged, is part of what allows power to operate without a challenge. But having said that, the fact is that if you think about what the role of education is in a democracy, even an aspirational democracy, even a flawed and partial democracy, it includes the ability to work and participate in society, but it includes at the center the right to be a citizen, the right to understand what's going on and make considered judgments between conflicting claims. That's what these kids are now suing, these families are now suing, saying our educational system fails to create in us the possibility of being fully participating, fully activated citizens. And that is a crime against the future. And it's something that we ought to all fight for.
We will leave it there. That was the voice of Bill Ayers, who joined us from Chicago. Bill is a noted activist, educator, and the co-author of the new book, You Can't Fire the Bad Ones, and 18 Other Myths About Teachers, Teachers Unions, and Public Education. Check out his work at www.billayers.org. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll take a short break and come right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Three St. Louis police officers who beat an undercover colleague during a protest last year turned themselves in after being indicted on federal charges. A fourth also was indicted for lying to a grand jury about the incident. We're joined from St. Louis by Reverend Daryl Gray. He's a longtime civil rights activist and candidate for alderman in St. Louis's 18th Ward, and he was arrested in the demonstration where the beating took place. And we're joined from St. Louis by Christine Hendricks. She's an activist and vice president of the University City School District. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. It's good to be here.
Reverend Gray, let's start with you. There's a lot to this case. It's not just that these police officers beat another undercover police officer. There were a lot of text messages going back and forth between these officers talking about how much they were going to enjoy beating people at the demonstration that you were taking part in. They were using racist language, and they made no secret whatsoever that they intended to use violence going into this demonstration. Tell us what it was like that night.
It was very hectic that night. It was the first evening following the acquittal. Protest leaders like Christine and I had already planned to do simultaneous protests that night, and we anticipated that the police would respond the way they did, and that's unfortunate, but we anticipated it because the governor had already flexed. He had already indicated that he was prepared to send troops into the city. There are already armored personnel carriers in the city, and the police for days had indicated that they would be on high alert. We had already encountered, you know, days, weeks, months ago, we already knew the viciousness and the hatred and the racism that was in the St. Louis Police Department because it had been perpetuated upon individual citizens. And so we knew that there was a tenseness. We expected it, but we didn't expect that it would go as far as it did that particular night.
Brian, you've participated in demonstrations like this. You've led demonstrations like this. This isn't specific to St. Louis, is it? This happens all over the country.
That's clearly the case. But let's bring in Christine Hendricks. Yeah, it's not unusual, but what's unusual, perhaps, Christine, is that there's a full record of how the police actually talk to each other. Here's Dustin Boone quoted in testimony. The texts say, "Let's whoop some and other derogatory language, racist language." They're going to the protest with the goal of inflicting violence on people who are gathering together to exercise their First Amendment right to speak out, to assemble, and to redress grievances. That's what's unusual, is that we actually have a record of what they said and how they talk.
Yeah, I just think that, you know, it's just funny because, you know, for so long, Black folks have been speaking out and other, you know, oppressed communities have been speaking out and saying, you know, this is what's going on. This is how, you know, the police talk. The police have been infiltrated by racist people, including people who have affiliations with the KKK and other neo-Nazi groups. And yet and still, you know, this isn't new. This has been going on for years. And it takes something like this in order for the public to believe us, to believe the things that we've been saying, to believe that, you know, we're not going out into the street and putting our bodies on the line for nothing.
Reverend Gray, it seems to me that St. Louis or Ferguson nearby St. Louis has in many ways become the epicenter not only of the struggle against police violence, that struggle that manifests itself all over the country, but because of the way the rebellions took place in Ferguson, the enduring protest of people in the St. Louis area, it's given rise to a whole new movement, a whole new generation of struggle. Do you in St. Louis, do you feel that way about your area?
Oh, no question. And we've said that St. Louis city and region has become the new Selma. And we've said that, of course, you know, following Trayvon and following the death of Mike Brown, the murder of Mike Brown, that this became the epicenter, ground zero for the new civil rights movement. And without question, the activists, the protesters, the frontline people like Christine and Bruce Franks and Cori Bush and Michael Haslam and so many others that have been on the front line, these are our new Martin Kings. These are our new Septima Clarks and Rosa Parks and Daisy Bates, and they really are. And what these young people bring, they bring the manual from the civil rights movement, but they have modernized that manual, and that manual and their work and their passion is being mimicked throughout the country, be it Baltimore, be it Dallas, be it Chicago, and that's what's happening right now. And people are watching what happens and what is coming out of St. Louis and the St. Louis region.
What's the next step then for demonstrators and activists? The cops and their case aside, this is such a much bigger story here. What's next?
Well, I think that one of the things that that's next, and one of the things that I'm personally working on, is like truth and reconciliation, truth and reparations. You know, with all of the things that have been going on that we've been seeing in the news, have been happening to our protest family and just to regular citizens here in the United States, we really need to have a reckoning where people are allowed to speak their truth and there's some kind of reparative action that's taken place. Because in order for our country to move forward and to heal, we have to acknowledge our racist and violent past and acknowledge that it can no longer be part of our future.
And for us, well, we're going from protest to politics. We're trying to get young people like Christine and others to now look at moving into the political arena in order to develop and create policy that will speak to these injustices and that will hold people accountable.
That's the voice of Reverend Darrell Gray. Reverend Gray is a longtime civil rights activist and candidate for alderman in St. Louis 18th Ward. He was arrested in the demonstration where the beating took place. And we were also joined from St. Louis by Christine Hendricks. Christine is an activist and vice president of the University City School District. Christine Hendricks, I want to follow up on the issue of the role of young people. I mean, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was just 26 years old at the time of Rosa Parks' arrest and the beginning of the Montgomery bus boycott. Hard to believe that someone so young could be such a senior leader of that movement. But then when you looked around at the other figures, they were also people in their early 20s, people in their teens. Do you see a similar process?
Oh, absolutely. I see so many young people that I'm proud of, people who are younger than me. I'm in my late 30s. And so, you know, I see people like one of my school board members and director and secretary, Chelsea Addison, who's, I think she's right around 26, 27. Farrakhan Shigog, who was a candidate for my district, Mo 86, who is an amazing young person who is so active in the community and so involved with other young people and getting other young people, you know, into community service as well as politics. I'm happy to know these people. I'm happy to work with them and, you know, happy to carry on this rich tradition of fighting for our human rights and fighting to be seen and to be heard.
When we were talking about the mid-50s and the birth of, well, it wasn't the birth, but the next stage of the enduring civil rights movement that took off after the Montgomery bus boycott, you can skip ahead, you know, 60 years. There may have been a couple generation skips there in terms of activism, but it seems to me that it's back in full throttle. And when when people are in the streets, when they're organizing, when they're mobilizing, when they're working together, they must form organizations. Of course, there's local organizations, but ultimately, because the problem is a nationwide problem, people look to see, is there an organization that can cohere, that can bring people together, that can give direction and leadership on the national level? Do you see or do you hear discussions, Reverend Gray, about people trying to move in that direction?
No, I think that they're not. I think that they're actually doing the opposite. I think that one thing that Ferguson taught us is that we have to localize our leadership. We have to regionalize our leadership. No longer can it simply be the Al Sharptons and the Jesse Jacksons and that type of charismatic leadership from the top. So when you look at people like Christine, when you look at people like Bruce Franks, when you look at people like Farrakhan Shigog and just around the country, I think that that's what was created after Ferguson, the regional, local leadership, where what we found is that we're not leaderless, we're leaderful. And so what we've done is bring together the regional organizations and create the coalitions and the alliances. And I think that has been our strength. It was definitely our strength during Stockley.
That's the voice of Reverend Daryl Gray. Christine Hendricks, we have about 45 seconds. Why don't you take us out?
Yeah, I would just say that there are some movements that are kind of national. For instance, one that I belong to, the Truth Telling Project. We have national offices and places, ways that people can get in touch and meet people from different areas and parts of the movement. Because I agree with Reverend Gray, it should be local and regional, but we should also have a connection to each other. And I'd say on the political front, I'd say Brand New Congress is finding leaders in the local level and running them in races that are important to the people in that community.
Well, we were very pleased to have from St. Louis, Reverend Daryl Gray. He's a longtime civil rights activist and candidate for alderman in St. Louis's 18th Ward, and he was arrested in the demonstration where the beating took place last week. And we were also joined from St. Louis by Christine Hendricks. She's an activist and vice president of the University City School District. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
The far-right Vox Party stunned Spain this weekend by winning seats in the Andalusian regional parliament. The party won 12 seats and 11% of the vote on a platform of expelling all immigrants from Spain and ending Catalonia's political autonomy. We're joined from Barcelona by Dick Nichols, the correspondent for Spain and Catalonia for Green Left Weekly. Welcome back, Dick.
Nice to be here.
Dick, this is a trend in most European Union countries. We're seeing a surge in support for far right-wing parties. How seriously should we take this development in Spain?
Oh, I think it's a very serious development, but it's not as surprising as it might sound, because people used to say, well, Spain, that's the place where there's no far-right party. But what you've had is the far-right has been far-right current, you know, far-right sentiment, anti-immigrant, anti-woman sentiment, anti-refugee sentiment, that has been inside the mainstream People's Party. And the reason for that goes back to these parties coming out of the old Francoist dictatorship. This party, Vox, is really not so new. It's basically a right split from the People's Party, who thought seeing the Catalonia question here, which is the big hot issue, which provoked big Spanish nationalist reactions, and combining that with all the themes that are present in far-right parties in the rest of Europe, especially against immigration and refugees, here was an opportunity. And then they were boosted by the media. They did one big conference celebration, mass meeting in Madrid, but then all the media, especially the right-wing media, boosted this. So they became a theme. And they went from being a party that only got 18,000 votes at the last Andalusian elections to being a party that had crossed a psychological threshold. And people felt, now it's worth voting for these people.
Yeah, it seems to me that this is well in line with so many other right-wing, far-right-wing political parties across Europe. In Greece, for example, the Golden Dawn Party is now the third largest party in parliament. And it's a nationwide party. We're seeing even worse situations in places like the Czech Republic and Austria, Slovenia. We're seeing the right ascendant in even places like Sweden and Denmark and the Netherlands. This is not unique to Spain.
No, it's not at all unique to Spain. It's come late in Spain because in Spain, as I tried to explain, in Spain, the far right was a wing inside, if you had a place inside the People's Party, but now basically provoked by the struggle in Catalonia. That's what this is, and this whole Andalusian election was not actually an election about Andalusia. It was a run-up to a national election about what are we going to do about Catalan independentism. And so this was a hysterical election campaign in which the three parties of the right, the People's Party, Citizens, and Vox, competed to see who could be the more harder towards the Catalans. And Vox easily won that competition because its position is that they should eliminate all regional structures in the Spanish state. So there should be just a single Spanish state with you get rid of the Basques. There's no Basque autonomous region. There's no Catalan region. There are just administrative divisions. And this is basically the old Francoist program, which they put out without any sense of shame at all.
Dick Nichols is our guest. Dick, you know, when we think about the rise of fascism, we see it periodically. We saw it certainly in the 1920s and the 1930s in continental Europe. It had manifestations in every advanced, industrially advanced society or advanced capitalist society, not in the Soviet Union. But we had a situation where you have the rise of capitalism coincided with the rise of the nation state. And when capitalism goes into crises, the nation state thus becomes sort of a place where nationalism is promoted and preached within a very narrow kind of political orientation. And that coinciding with economic problems like unemployment or high prices, social and economic dislocation caused by the same economic order, it seems as if the rise of far-right nationalism or fascism is something that's almost organic to this particular economic order. Once suppressed, it still revives down the road. Do you see it that way?
I would maybe, I don't know whether I disagree or agree with that, but I would stress a few other points, Brian. In Spain, you have the specific question of the national question. Spain is most like Russia and most like Turkey. That is, it is a multinational state in which there's a dominant nationalism, which is determined to defend its position, and which in Spain takes the form of Spanish centralism, closely associated with the monarchy, and which is determined to deny the right of self-determination to the other component nations. So this is like Turkey with the Kurds or Russia. So that's a specific characteristic. And certainly these elections we've just been through in Andalusia, that was what it was all about. That was the key theme, but that was the big theme. But there are other things were there as well. Migrants in particular, just to explain a couple of things, the vote for Vox was highest in the areas, as a direct correlation, where you have highest extra EU immigration from Latin America and immigration from Africa. And this is extremely unjust, just passing, because this immigration is needed to do the jobs that nobody else wants to do, which is basically working in greenhouses, especially in the province of Almeria, which is known as the Sea of Plastic, which is just produces fruit and vegetables all year long and people have to work under abominable conditions. And the majority of people here are migrant workers. But it's in these areas that the vote for Vox is highest. And the other point I would make is that the rise of Vox and the rightward shift in the positions of the PP and Citizens corresponds to having to defeat the left. That is to say, there's two enemies here. There's separatism, namely the Catalans, basically led by the Catalans at the moment, but also including the Basques and the Galicians. And there's also against the left. So it's like a re-emergence in 21st century conditions of the alliances that were there at the time of the Spanish Civil War. And the left in all its all-Spanish left, plus the oppressed nationalities.
Okay, quick question then. So are you characterizing this thus as a right-wing nationalist development, again, targeting what are considered to be separatist or self-determination movements in, say, Catalonia or the Basque Country, as opposed to being actually a fascistic development? In other words, it's really a kind of mainstream politics with a far-right nationalist twist because of the peculiarities of Spain?
No, it's fascistic in the sense that, but it's, to use the right term, it's Francoist, because the national question has always been the unsolved question in the Spanish state. And the fascist dictatorship here, i.e. Francoism under General Franco, was a movement to assert Spanish centralism against the threat of the nationalities, the oppressed nationalities. This makes it different from Germany and makes it different from Italy, you know, classical fascism, classical Nazism. But it's the same stuff in Spanish history. But what we have is a revival of Francoism, which has always been there, and it's always been there because the dictatorship was not defeated in the transition. What happened was that there was a deal done between the dictatorship and the democratic forces, unlike Portugal, unlike Italy, unlike Greece. And so the position of Francoism has always been much stronger here compared to those other countries. But there's always been a debate amongst the heirs of Franco about what is their policy to defend that heritage, how hard or how soft they should be. And Vox represents, in this election, a shameless reassertion of the essence of Francoism. So you can call it fascism, as many people do here call it fascism, and we don't want to get into a sort of silly, you know, debate about vocabulary. But that's the specifically Spanish state difference that it has to fascism and Nazism. The disillusionment with the Socialist Party, which has ruled in Andalusia for 40 years and has never been out of government, but with increasing disillusionment caused by corruption, because by the lack of development in the place, because of the high and intransigent rate of unemployment, this disillusionment didn't go to the left. That is to say, it didn't go to Podemos or to the United Left. It went to abstention. The abstention rate, as I say, went up by 5%. So the left, to the left of the Socialist Party, did not succeed in capturing this discontent. If that percentage or a substantial part of it had gone to the left, then the picture would have been very different.
That was the voice of Dick Nichols, who joined us from Barcelona. He's the correspondent for Spain and Catalonia for Green Left Weekly. You've been listening to Loud and Clear. We're completely out of time. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. And you can follow us on Twitter at Loud Clear Radio. You can hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can also hear us at SputnikNews.com and as a podcast at iTunes, iHeartRadio, Spreaker, and Spotify. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We'll see you next time.
Loud and Clear.
Love.